Attorney General Bondi told Trump he was in those files. Well, what are those files? Why can't we see them? And I don't think that anything that they do with Ghislaine Maxwell is going to stop people from asking those questions, not going to stop me from asking those questions. If Trump has nothing to be afraid of, why not just release the files?
Hello, everyone. Welcome to George Conway Explains It All to Sarah Longwell. He's George Conway. I am not Sarah Longwell. I'm JVL, her best friend from the Bulwark. George.
I can't explain it all. I cannot explain it all.
Well, you're going to have to.
I can't. I do not have the Epstein files. I cannot explain it all because I do not have the Epstein files. And I'm going on strike. I will not explain anything until I see the Epstein files.
Well, okay. So there's a lot to talk about with Epstein. And I guess I'd like to start with Ghislaine Maxwell. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Ghislaine. Well, the deputy attorney general misspelled it the other day, which was a faux pas. Oof.
Oh, well, I feel like you should get a mulligan. It's a foreign name. So Jonathan Turley, one of the great legal minds of our time today, posited that, Ms. Maxwell could be very, very useful because she has a couple of options. She could testify about some of the very bad Democrats who are on the Epstein list and provide information that the government could use to prosecute, say, Bill Clinton or Barack Obama for their participation. And then in exchange for that, she could get a reduced sentence. And this would be very helpful to Trump. Or she could just testify that Trump didn't do anything. And then, maybe he pardons her. Are we at that moment where Ghislaine Maxwell is about to become like a real thing on the right? Are they about to embrace her?
I don't know. I mean, I've been trying to figure out this play for the for Trump. How do you play this? Okay, you've got this woman who clearly knows a lot, right? And she knows these two besties from way back in the day. And she's seen a lot of things. How do you make it stick, though, right? Let's say you're President of the United States, speaking hypothetically.
Sure.
And you have this pardon power, and you give her a pardon. How do you make it stick so that she doesn't change her story henceforth when some piece of paper comes out that says that, something that's contrary to what she might say about the President of the United States today when she's seeking to curry her favor for said pardon? So how do you lock her in is sort of the question, is one question. And I don't see how this whole thing can make all the stuff about the files go away. Because if they do go, and as you say, make accusations against Democrats who may or may not have been on the list, or may or may not have been to the Epstein mansion or on Air Lolita or on Epstein Island or on the flight logs or, on any little piece of paper that might be in the Epstein files. If you charge some people like that, they're going to want to see all the Epstein files, right? And they're going to probably be able to get them because you're entitled that you have to put on a defense, assuming they do criminal.
Well, you don't
charges.
Ever have to actually charge them, right? You could just investigate.
I guess that's right. You could just say that, but it still doesn't seem right because where are the documents? Where is the list that Pam Bondi said that was on her list? Where are these files that we now know exist? That we now know, according to the Wall Street Journal, Deputy Attorney General Blanche and Attorney General Bondi told Trump he was in those files. Well, what are those files? Why can't we see them? And I don't think that anything that they do with Ghislaine Maxwell is going to stop people from asking those questions. It's not going to stop me from asking those questions. If Trump has nothing to be afraid of, why not just release the files? There seems to be a big deal about these files. He doesn't want to release them for some
reason. But he doesn't need George Conway to stop asking questions, right? He needs to get 40% of the country, who already voted for him three times, to stop asking questions. That's it, right? Because that's survivable for him.
But that's not what they want. They don't want, they didn't want these files because they wanted assurance that Donald Trump wasn't in the files. Didn't even occur to them that Donald Trump was in the files, probably, even though, you know, the rest of the world that watches news and sees things knows that they were buddies for a very long time. They just want the files. They want to know everything about who is in this conspiracy that we know, because we believe in QAnon, or at least we believe in the central tenets of QAnon, at least, you know, according to a post-election survey, fully a third of Republican Trump supporters believe in the principal tenets of QAnon. I could not name the first two. The third is that there is this massive conspiracy amongst the intellectual and economic and political elites of the country to traffic in young people for sex. And that's what they're interested in. They want to know who those people are. And so why can't we see the files?
Okay, so this is why I, just as a political matter, it's not a legal matter, but as a political matter, can't you satisfy those people by saying, so the reason those people are upset is because Pam Bondi of the Justice Department just said there is no conspiracy, right? That's what they don't want to hear. They don't, because the Justice Department statement, the unsigned statement that they released was just like, actually, there is no conspiracy. That's what Kash Patel then went and testified to. That doesn't work. The people don't want to hear that. But if instead you say, it turns out the files themselves have nothing in them because they're part of the conspiracy, the real truth is going to come from the mouth of Ms. Maxwell. We got to forget the files. We got to get her on record. That's where the real truth and the real conspiracy starts. Let's go talk to her.
But they put her in prison.
Doesn't that work?
No, because somebody put her in jail for something. What was that?
It's probably the deep state. I mean, for all I know,
who was in charge of the deep state in 2019?
Oh, I mean, it's impossible to say, George. We can't know that.
We don't know because the deep state wouldn't tell us.
No.
I mean, there was this guy. He looks from similar to the current guy, except he was a little younger.
Yeah.
Didn't make much more sense. Some people think he made more sense back then. I don't really
think
so. How
could we ever know?
It's a matter. I don't know. They put her in jail for trafficking in children. Seems like she's part of the conspiracy. How can we trust her?
Well, I mean, if she finds Jesus, doesn't that always erase all sins?
Huh.
I'm just saying. Well, that's the thing that happens.
I'm just trying to figure this out. I don't see the play here, honestly. I think it's very nice if you get Maxwell to say stuff, but I don't expect people to say.
You don't think it's enough?
Well, no, because she's part of the conspiracy. And what else do the documents say? Is she going to say that? What is she going to say? Is she going to say the documents are a hoax? How do we know? Are they going to show her the documents? A lot of questions.
Well, now you're raising some good questions.
I don't see them being answered. I don't see these questions being answered.
What is the end game for the documents? Like, where does this go?
The end game for the documents is I think they're going to be continued to be hidden from us. And people are going to continue to ask questions about, well, what's in those documents?
You think they just can't be released?
I mean, I think they could be released. I mean, I think there are some legal strictures as to some of them.
No, by can't, I mean like the executive branch, this version of the executive branch simply can't release. This is what I'm asking. Like, just as a
this version of the executive branch can't release them because the president of the United States apparently has some kind of deep aversion. I don't know where that comes from. It could be just he's just morally offended by some of the content because he has, you know, he's a very sensitive man and you know, it's just beneath him to talk about things that involve such gutter subjects as sex and whatnot. He would never have anything to do with that. He's very prudish. I don't see him releasing those files.
Are there ways for, let's pretend the Democrats take back the House and start subpoenaing people. Are there ways for the Democrats to get their hands on the files through like subpoena power and stuff like that? Or is that really like, no, Congress doesn't have the ability to do that?
Congress would probably have a difficult time subpoenaing criminal investigatory files of the Justice Department. I agree with that. In fact, Congress, they tried to do that with the Biden administration with January 6th stuff. I think they did try to do some stuff like that. I think it would be hard unless the administration didn't put up a defense and said, sure, have these. But I don't think the administration's going to do that.
That seems unlikely.
No. It just seems to me that we are in this permanent state of where are the files and why won't you release them? And we're not going to release them. I don't, you know, that's not such a terrible state to be if you're not anybody but Donald Trump.
I don't know. Is it? I feel like that's the kind of thing that he can ride out over time, right?
Maybe he can ride it out over time. I guess he's not doing a very good job of it thus far. It seems to annoy him when people.
It does
talk
seem
about
to annoy him, and so he's trying. We'll talk about the Obama Strike Force in a minute. All right, George. So yesterday, I think it was yesterday. The Department of Justice announced that they have a strike force, not a task force, George, a strike force,
which
is going to be investigating Obama's role in the Jeffrey Epstein hoax. As a legal professional, can you explain to me what a legal strike force is? Is it like a Kraken? Or like what?
The Justice Department has these things that they call strike forces and task forces. I mean, governments have task forces. It makes it look like they're doing tasks. I don't think there's any more legal significance to that. I've heard of organized crime strike forces, where they kind of create little special offices throughout the country. I remember there was one in New Haven, Connecticut, when I was a young lawyer. And they specialize in certain things. But I don't think they have anything to strike here, honestly, because, I mean, it is an amazing coincidence. Just spectacular coincidence that Donald Trump falls into evidence that he believes shows that Barack Obama committed treason. Just happens to happen the very week he's in the soup about the Epstein papers. He's just a lucky guy.
Coincidences happen all the time.
Incredible coincidence. But that being said, I mean, I think we've kind of been through this before. We've had Russia hoax. Have you heard about him saying it was a hoax? And then we had Bill Barr. He appointed a special counsel to investigate the Russia hoax, was it? And that guy went on for years, spent a lot of money. His name was John Durham. He was actually part of the organized crime strike force in New Haven that I mentioned. Actually,
it all comes
strange
together.
Coincidence, strange coincidence. And he lost two of the three cases he brought, and none of it really showed anybody important doing anything wrong. So I don't think they've got very much here. I think it just seems kind of desperate.
Is it common in criminal law for the director of national intelligence to be the tip of the spear, making the case that criminal behavior has been committed
in the U.S.? No, not generally.
That seems unorthodox.
It does seem unorthodox, although, of course, in major counterintelligence investigations, there's obvious close coordination between the line justice prosecutors in the Division of National Security at the Department of Justice and the IC generally. But, you know, amazing how she just came up with this stuff. Maybe it was sitting under, you think it may have been somebody had left it, somebody screwed up in the Biden administration, left this stuff under the desk there in the corner office that the DNI gets for the national, I don't know.
Maybe. Was it a dead drop? I guess here's my question. So the president of the United States shared with America a AI-generated deepfake video which featured Barack Obama being handcuffed and manhandled in the Oval Office. I assume you saw this. He has said that he believes that the evidence is right there, that Obama has committed treason. I guess my question is, why hasn't Barack Obama been arrested, George?
Shouldn't we demand
that he be arrested? Like, I really want this criminal case to be prosecuted. Like, I feel like America needs to have this trial.
He shouldn't even have time. He shouldn't even have time to go to CVS and get his toothbrush. That would be too lenient if he committed treason. Absolutely.
So what is, to be serious and not sarcastic for just a moment, what is the legal remedy? Right. Like if somebody says you've committed treason, but we're not going to prosecute or anything. You could file a frivolous defamation suit. Could you not? Knowing that you would lose this defamation suit, but people seem to settle frivolous defamation suits all the time these days.
Yeah,
that seems to be a thing that happens like every third Thursday.
I mean, the problem is you have, at least with the president, you have presidential immunity. With others, you might not have that kind of immunity. Certainly with the president, there would be absolute immunity.
Tulsi Gabbard doesn't.
No, she might have some immunity. I don't know if she'd have immunity for this. Yeah, I think you could probably, you know, and there are lots of claims that are not just defamation claims that you could bring. I mean, there are due process claims that sometimes get brought when the government declares somebody to have done something and they fail. They actually don't have the evidence.
Tell me how that works.
These are tough claims to assert. I think the a straight up defamation claim in the context of somebody who doesn't have any official immunity defense, who doesn't work from the government, if they had made these accusations, I think that would be a pretty reasonably straightforward defamation claim. I mean, the difficulty is always
public figure, actual malice, et cetera.
You know, what was actually in their mind actually does matter to some.
But the point of this isn't to actually win a defamation claim, right? I mean, the point of this is to inflict pain.
Yeah, and I don't know to what extent it would inflict pain, because the difference between the government bringing these lawsuits or Trump bringing these lawsuits against people outside the government is that the government, you know, these people have to pay their own defense. Whereas if somebody sued Tulsi Gabbard for making false statements about Barack Obama, the Justice Department would end up defending the case. So I don't know to what extent bringing a lawsuit, even a meritorious one, would be to help this situation. But, you know, could have some fun with it. That's not crazy.
So you said that there are ways to seek, what was the term you used? Like when the government due process claims?
I have read of claims, and I haven't done the research lately, but there are claims where you can There are due process claims that can be brought where the government makes some kind of a declaration or a finding about someone that is just without foundation and hasn't been made with due inquiry. I think there are some potential due process claims there. I'd have to go back and look at the case law to see whether that would apply here, particularly in a circumstance where there's supposedly some criminal investigation that is predicated on the basis of whatever this woman is saying. There are potential. Let's just say there are potential claims. I don't know whether bringing them makes sense or will do any practical good. That's the bottom line.
Seems like it's a problem if there's no legal remedy to the government claiming that you are a criminal and waging a public campaign against you for criminal activity, if they then won't allow you to litigate those claims.
Actually, you don't have to prove your innocence. They have to prove your guilt.
Right. Yes. But isn't that kind of a problem? Is that typical? Is this new? Is this the kind of thing that has happened before?
I'm sure it has happened before in some context of government officials making false accusations against people, but I don't think it's really happened to this extent. You know, one president of the United States who is facing political pressure because his sex predator friend was investigated by the government and prosecuted by the government, and then there are these files that the government now has from its investigation of the sex predator friend that implicate, or maybe not implicate, or at least have been contained the name of the president of the United States, and the president of the United States responds by accusing another president of the United States, a former president of the United States, of treason, and then the DNI then says she's got files. So, this is going farther than I think that people have gone before. Yes, I do.
Well, it's a good thing the Supreme Court didn't expand the zone of presidential immunity.
Well, it did. They kind of did. Well, I think this wouldn't, you know.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Well, that was an oopsie.
It's a problem. Oops. They shouldn't. Yeah. Problem. That's the problem when you decide cases that aren't before you.
All right. So listen, we had some fun with good news at the top of the show. I would like to talk about some bad news, and then we can finish with some
bad
more good news.
Okay.
So Colombia has reached a $200 million
bad
settlement
news.
With the federal government. I got to say, I don't understand this. I don't understand
the
capitulation. I don't understand why they would settle. None of this makes any sense to me. And I was wondering if you could help me try to understand, A, what just happened here, B, why it happened, and C, where this goes from here. Because it seems to me like you've taken the Dane gelt and you're not going to get rid of the Dane here.
Yeah, I don't know why they did it. I think it's terrible that they've done it. I think it just encourages Trump to go after more universities. Maybe it has something to do. Obviously the protests that occurred after the events in Gaza and the attack on Israel on October 7th got particularly heated at Columbia. And I don't know enough about that fight to really pass judgment on what Columbia did. I don't think it necessarily covered itself in glory, but did it do something that would render itself liable to the government for being anti-Semitic? It's kind of hard for me to accept that because I don't think of Columbia as being an anti-Semitic institution overall. I mean, obviously it has there's a lot of controversy over Israel's subsequent conduct of the Gaza war. I think it's just they didn't want to fight. I think they must have looked at their budget and they must have said, we can't afford to do this. That's the only reason I can think of why they would do this. And
$200 million is real money, though, George.
It's real money. I guess maybe it's, I don't, you know, again, is it real money in the same sense that that we had those law firms talking about real money? Is that real money? I don't know. I haven't studied this deal. Maybe there's something about it that, maybe they're round tripping money somehow. Like, I don't know. So I think that, I think it's just a terrible, it just sends the wrong signal, as with all these other settlements of people just sort of caving to the administration for meritless things and giving the administration a win that it doesn't deserve, and makes the administration look like it's doing something useful, which it isn't. And I mean, the good news is Harvard's going to stick to its guns, I'm sure.
But what the government is doing is it seems to be inserting itself into like day-to-day operations at Columbia University, where it is going to determine what organizations are allowed on campus, what the campus policies are going to be around protests, whether or not admissions uses different criteria, whether or not there's support for student groups that are deemed acceptable versus unacceptable. And I mean, we all have to understand that the fact of the government doing this means that they will be tested, right? I mean, somebody's going to write an op-ed for the student paper, which is purposefully designed to flout the government's preferred ideas. And that will be a provocation daring the government to then come in and extract more punishment, right? It's just like some professor is going to put together a syllabus whose entire, you know, a tenured professor whose entire composition is designed to be a provocation. It's like, you know, they'll have all the DEIs in the syllabus, right? It'll be all Edward Said.
And then throw in a from the river to the sea thing,
like in a section header for, you know, today's class. Exactly. We're going to talk about from the river to the sea, and we're talking about the Euphrates River and the Mediterranean Sea. Right, you can see,
not the Long Island Sound
and
the Hudson River. No.
So, I mean, I guess I don't mean to sound alarmist, but when I look for parallels to this, the only thing I see is in, like, I don't see parallels in U.S. law. I see parallels in, like, Hungary.
Hungary, yeah. There was this government in Germany at some point that got into this stuff. I agree with that.
How do these things get, and I guess this is, so here's my question to you. How do you move backwards? Because I guess...
We're doing it quite successfully.
No. I mean, backwards in, like, from this. Like, how do you step back from this abyss? Because you can say, like, okay, well, you elect a different president next time, and that administration decides to not attempt to control the universities. Well, okay, well, at some point, though, there will be another Republican president, and that president has established the legal precedent that he can use his government to at least temporarily take over the affairs of any university he chooses.
Yeah, I don't think necessarily this is that's the precedent that's going to be established, because I do think that you're absolutely right. People are going to push the boundaries of this, and there are going to be all sorts of claims against the university and against the government of the United States. I'll give you an example. The New York City human rights law basically has, it protects all the rights you would think that you have under the U.S. Constitution, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, but it also protects them against private individuals, which is sort of interesting. I mean, you can debate whether or not that makes sense in a lot of cases, but if you're punished by a university for speech, you may have a claim under New York state law. So you've got claims under New York state law. You may also have possible claims against the U.S. government, because to the extent that the government is pulling these strings, the actions, it's possible, I mean, I think it would take a lot of joint and cohesive activity pursuant to this agreement and otherwise, but you can sometimes tag the government with the conduct of a private actor if the private actor is acting essentially as the cat's paw for the government. So if, for example, I were a professor and I wrote something in the Columbia Spectator or our student and Columbia didn't do anything, okay, and then Linda McMahon, I'm just picking somebody, called up Claire Shipman and said, you need to get this person. And then she immediately caused the university to bring charges. That could be sufficient entanglement with a state actor to make Columbia's actions the actions of the U.S. government and vice versa. And so there could be, I absolutely agree with you when you say that there are going to be these enforcement aspects that are going to come up. And those are going to result in litigation. And those cases might not necessarily hold dear the proposition that the government can do this stuff. So, just to inject slight degree of optimism there. But, you know, again, it's going to require people who are willing to stand up to the university and to the government of the United States, and who are going to have, you know, they'll need well-funded lawyers, I think. And I think there'll be a lot of volunteers to do that.
All right, well, we're going to get to some candy. We're going to finish the show with candy about Alina Haba. But you got to wait.
Alina. You got to wait. Oh, Alina.
Okay, so Alina Haba, who is the most qualified ever U.S. attorney in New Jersey history, is she a U.S. attorney or an assistant U.S. attorney? I guess
She was appointed to be the acting United States attorney, the acting or interim United States attorney, and then she was nominated for the position to be confirmed by the Senate. And ultimately, it does to be a permanent U.S. attorney, or at least for a full term as U.S. attorney, you have to be appointed and approved by the Senate. But she is no more because her interim appointment lapsed. And then, as is perfectly legal and happens very frequently, when the temporary appointment lapses, the judges of a district can vote in a U.S. attorney. Often it's the same person that the administration picks, but sometimes it isn't. And in this case, they picked someone else, the first deputy of the office, a woman named Grace. Her last name is Grace. And then the administration promptly fired her. And it's unclear whether that sticks because there's a technical aspect there of the firing. You see, once
is
the
that
court
legal?
Appoints...
Is that wrongful termination?
Not necessarily. I mean, look, the Justice Department can fire any assistant United States attorney. This woman was an assistant United States attorney. And Pam Bondi or somebody probably even under her could fire her as an assistant United States attorney.
Oh, because they're a political appointee, right?
Well, no, they're not. They're actually not political appointees, but they are. I mean, they're subject to some civil service protections, but they are subject to being fired by someone other than the president because they weren't appointed by the president. The other thing, though, that's happened here, though, is that the court made Ms. Grace, the U.S. attorney, the interim or acting U.S. attorney, and that can only be undone by the president himself. Only the president can fire a U.S. attorney, whether that U.S. attorney is appointed by him or by a federal court. So the question is, did Trump actually do this, or was it somebody at the Justice Department? Todd Blanche at some point did say that it was Trump. But normally you'd want to see some evidence that the president of the United States actually did something, like here's the written order, or here's a statement by the president, because that would eliminate confusion about who issued this order. And until it's really ironed out and made clear that Trump did this, it's unclear who the, whether there is a U.S. attorney in the District of New Jersey.
So, like, this woman, Grace, is she at the office? Like, this seems a weird thing, right? Is she, if nobody knows if she has been lawfully fired or not, is she collecting a paycheck, or, you know, is her time clock being punched?
Well, I mean, I would assume that she's not collecting a paycheck because the people who control the issuance of paychecks are probably at the Justice Department. But yeah, there's confusion right now as to who is and whether there is a U.S. attorney, either, you know, acting or interim. There's a question of whether there is anybody running the office in the U.S. attorney's office in the District of New Jersey, which kind of is a thing. It's kind of a big thing.
So this woman, Desiree Lee Grace, she, I mean, I guess she has the option to just be a team player and say, yes, yes, sir, I'm fired, and thank you for it. May I have another? And just walk away, right? Because if she walks away, then there's nobody, you know, maybe she even says she's resigning.
Well, then they have a problem. They have to go find somebody else to appoint. And there's a debate as to whether they could reappoint Alina Hama.
Well, does the administration do that, or do the judges fill that?
Well, there's a question as to, well, that's sort of, you're asking a very good question, because there is a question as to whether or not the administration can appoint somebody to another 120-day term. And so very, you know, I haven't looked into it. It involves a weird interplay between specific statutes governing the U.S. appointment of U.S. attorneys and then something called the Vacancies Act, which is very, very complicated and difficult. And I know of two law professors who are the biggest experts in the world on this, and they disagree on whether or not the administration can reappoint Alina Hama or appoint somebody else for another 120 days. So let's set that aside. But the courts, as long as there is a vacancy, they can fill that vacancy and they could pick another name. They could pick you. They could pick me. Of course, I don't think that would last very long because I think the administration would veto that as well. But I honestly don't see, I don't know how this is going to play out.
So why wasn't, just the Senate didn't confirm her fast enough?
The Senate, well, I mean, the problem is that the two home state senators are blue-slipping Alina Hama because they don't want Alina Hama, who is thoroughly unqualified to be a practicing attorney in federal court. Okay. Let's start with the basics. She had to, you know, I mean, she represented Trump in some of the in some of the litigation he had before he became president. And one of them was the E. Jean Carroll case. And she had no idea how to introduce a document into evidence. And the judge was like looking at her like she had a hole in her head. But now she's the United States attorney, or she was. I guess she could have people introduce evidence for her. That was the idea.
But she just wants to run for governor anyway, right? I mean, isn't that, like, for her, this was just a way station to add something that looked like a grown-up thing to her resume. And she's going to run for statewide office in New Jersey. Because I think the Republicans think they're getting closer. I think Jack Cittarelli's, I think he lost by 5 points maybe to Murphy last time around. And I think Republicans in state believe that New Jersey is trending purple and that they can win here and that she is somebody they can maybe take a shot with.
Okay. You say so.
I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Somebody who's angling? I mean, she looks like somebody who's running for something, right?
She just looks like somebody who's running for attention, I guess. And maybe that is the equivalent. I mean, why should she run for anything when she can get Trump to appoint her to whatever she wants? I don't know. I just don't see her. Maybe she is. I just don't see her as a viable candidate for governor of New Jersey. But yeah, Anything can happen.
Donald Trump is president of these United States, George.
Yes, the ultimate rejoinder, the ultimate rejoinder.
Guys, thanks for hanging with us. Hit like, hit subscribe, follow the channel. We'll be back. We'll do this again next week. Maybe things will be better. Of course they won't. Good luck, America.
Well, George Conway, he's a man with a plan. Got to sit down with Sarah Longwell, take a stand, explain all the legal problems they're piling high. With Donald Trump, oh my, oh my, oh my. He said, Sarah, let me break it down for you. There's obstruction of justice, corruption to the legal tangles and troubles that grow in fast.